watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What's the meaning of the events of September 11, 2001? The official interpretation is that it is an opening assault in a battle by Al-Qaeda, a medieval-minded international group of Islamic terrorists opposed to freedom, which has necessitated a defensive response, an endless war on terrorism. If you watch closely, however, you'll see how this idea of terrorism is gradually showing itself to be a program of repression against anyone who opposes the freedom of corporations to turn everything and everyone into profitable opportunities. On this program, we've reported on legislation passed to define militant activism against biotechnology, agribusiness, and real estate speculation into terrorism. We recently saw a member of the New Orleans City Council label as terrorists public housing residents who protested the council's decision to demolish their homes to make way for upscale condos and real estate profit opportunities. The events of 9/11 have been used to justify not only wars of conquest against resource-rich nations, but also a system of surveillance, torture, and detention. It's been reported that about 700,000 people are now on a U.S. government no-fly list. Naomi Wolf, an author who's been touring to publicize her recent book, Warning of the Descent of the U.S. into Fascism, recently revealed during a Democracy Now! Interview that she, a Jewish feminist, is on that list. We've also reported on the statement of a retired U.S. military officer and Princeton law professor, Walter Murphy, who discovered he too was on that list after giving a televised speech critical of the Bush administration. We are told that the purpose of the no-fly list is to forestall persons who might hijack aircraft to use in future terrorist activities. It is beyond belief to imagine that Ms. Wolf or Professor Murphy or others similarly situated are on this list because they are potential hijackers. Rather, they appear to be on this list as a punishment for being prominent people who have spoken out against the administration. Our speaker this week is another prominent person punished for questioning the central enabling narrative of this program of war and repression, the official story of the events of 9/11. He's physicist Stephen Jones, who's been analyzing debris from the World Trade Center buildings for evidence of explosive used to bring about their collapse. His research, some of which has been previously aired on this program, has been zeroing in on the use of an incendiary compound called thermite to effect the controlled demolition of the buildings. On December 15th, he announced his most recent discovery at a talk given at a Boston 9/11 Truth Conference. He's discovered flakes of unreacted thermite in samples of the World Trade Center dust. We're going to bring you an excerpt of that talk where he explains these recent findings by himself and other 9/11 Truth Movement scientists and researchers who are part of the largest open-source, grassroots criminal investigation in history. Dr. Jones' discovery follows on his recent findings of anomalous particles in several samples of dust from the World Trade Center site. We'll begin the program with a presentation he made last June at a conference in Vancouver to update you on the investigation leading up to his present revelations. then end with a clip in which he describes the recent discovery. Here's Dr. Stephen Jones, introduced by Professor Kevin Barrett at the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society Conference.
When I started doing 9/11 truth activism a little over 3 years ago, I would be in the middle of the University Square Mall at the University of Wisconsin-Madison doing teach-ins, including 14-hour teach-ins on the anniversary of the attacks, marathon 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. teach-ins. And during these teach-ins, I often would be approached by scientists, especially engineers. And it seemed like every engineer had a different and completely ludicrous idea of what had happened to the World Trade Center. And as a humanities guy, I had a hard time trying to argue with these people. They said, well, you're not an engineer, what do you know? So I was very, very happy when the first reputable scientists started coming along and looking at 9/11 closely, employing their common sense. And what, probably the single most important breakthrough in terms of a scientist joining the 9/11 truth movement was when Stephen Jones got on board. And I am so impressed by his courage in standing, sticking by his guns and speaking the truth and doing the important research in this field. And I also have a lot of respect for the way he stood up to his own university administration. I know something about that. I spent a lot of last year on the hot seat standing down my university administration, which was not too happy that I was all over the newspapers, and they didn't want me to go on Fox and so on and so forth. And I ended up lucking out. I didn't get fired. Stephen Jones, on the other hand, a far more reasonable, soft-spoken, and charming guy, actually did get sort of shunted aside by his administration, given the golden parachute. And as I understand it, Steve isn't all that unhappy about getting early retirement and the golden parachute, but you know, still, he was forced out by his administration for standing up and speaking the truth, and I think that history will look very kindly on Stephen Jones.
Thank you so much. A warm welcome. A warm welcome means a great deal. I appreciate that, and I've enjoyed listening to the other speakers. Appreciate the organizers. Done a great job putting this together. So as I've gone around speaking about 9/11 and what I've learned about it in the past few years, I've developed a list of what I think are the five strongest and also perhaps the most interesting areas that demonstrate that the official 9/11 story is fishy, to say the least. Now, you would have a different list, I suspect. And I did some pondering over this list. It's not the same one I would have had a year ago. And if you heard my talk at UVSC, for example, this is a different list. And, of course, there's a lot new since a year and a half ago. It'd be number three, the melted spheres that we've looked at. And I'll spend some time discussing the data on these melted spheres that appear in the World Trade Center dust. In fact, let me just ask real quickly. I have talked about that a couple of times. How many of you have heard about these melted tiny spheres in the dust? A few, but not many. Okay, so that'll be new to you. All right. And I want to emphasize, too, there are other very important areas, lines of research. I believe that these five, is what I'm proposing, would be sufficient and solid enough to motivate and sustain an investigation and prevent weaseling, if I can put it that way, as people... I just don't see many debates on these points, that is, within the community or without even. These points are largely solid, okay? Collapse of Building 7, of course, we'll start with that. Before going to that, though, I would like to put in a plug for the Journal of 9/11studies.com, which I'm co-editor with Kevin Ryan, chemist. I've plotted here for you the distribution of papers in three-month intervals. So in the last 3 months, we've had 32 papers published. These are all peer-reviewed papers that I'm counting here in the journal. And so we have an increasing number, and that's encouraging to me and to Kevin, the co-editor, to see all these studies being done by scholars submitting papers, and I would encourage you to read. So there's my second question. How many of you have actually read something in the Journal of 9/11 Studies? Okay, quite a few, but I see I have some convincing to do yet, so let me try this. My paper, the first paper that I wrote in this field, came out in November, at least as a draft, November of 2005, within days. I had emails from a contractor who claimed to have Homeland Security contacts. I don't doubt that he did and does. And I'm quoting here from his email. So I'm inviting you to read this banned paper if you haven't yet. He said, "The publication of this article can be stopped, and I have the contacts to make this happen. You need to give this very serious consideration. This is an issue that is more important than any individual career." I think he was referring to my career. And then we did have some scientific discussion in addition to these rather threatening statements. And I answered his questions, and I was able to do that. And then he responded, "Well, I have learned to appreciate the value of silence, even in the case of superior data and information." Do you see what I'm saying? Shut up. I don't want to hear anymore about that. But he admitted that I had, you know, superior data and information. And then, again, trying to push me to pull my paper, he said, "As painful as it may seem now, perhaps it may be less painful than it could occur after publication." Now, about 2 or 3 weeks after the paper was formally published in a volume edited by Professors Griffin and Scott, Peter Dale Scott is here at this conference. Anyway, just a couple weeks after that was formally published, I was put on administrative leave and soon offered, as Kevin mentioned, early retirement, which after discussions with my wife, we decided that would probably be the wiser course of action in this case. And so it's okay. Now I want to persuade you a little more to read. Here are some of the authors in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. We have David Griscom, who is a physicist and a fellow of the American Physical Society, wrote a paper about the collapse of the World Trade Center. Greg Jenkins, also a physicist, PhD. Here's Kevin Ryan, co-editor, and he lost his job, by the way, by speaking out with regard to 9/11. But don't let that scare you. We're carrying on, you know, we're here, we're healthy, and so on. Thank God. Okay. David Ray Griffin, Professor Griffin. Graham McQueen has written two articles in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He's at McMaster University, right? A few years back, several nudges finally got me to look seriously then at these issues. And it was when I saw the collapse of Building 7 that I decided this was something that I couldn't just ignore. This is very serious and fishy, okay? So we'll talk then first about the collapse of Building 7. There seems to be unanimity in the community about the importance of this collapse of this building. This skyscraper is 47 stories tall, solidly constructed, of course, across the street and about 110 meters away from the nearest tower. That would be the North Tower, closest. And after the towers had collapsed, we have a photo from the World Trade Center Plaza area. And this is the World Trade Center 7 building in the afternoon. Now, it came down at 5:20 p.m. As you can see, we don't have an inferno going on here in the afternoon. There were fires, to be sure, random fires, and there was random damage also from the tower as it fell. But the damage would be on the face closest. That would be the south face. And, you know, if anything, you'd think it would fall immediately if damage was the reason, or at least if it's later, that should fall towards the weakened side. But watch, it doesn't do that. And the random fires, you see. So let's see how it does fall. We have building 7 on the left and a controlled demolition using explosives for comparison on the right. The fall was complete and symmetrical. A little dip in the middle, just as you often see in controlled demolitions, which I'm sure you've seen those before too with explosives. And then the building came straight down onto its footprint. This is the goal of controlled demolitions. And I saw that and I thought, man, this thing was never hit by a jet. And yet, look at the way it comes down. It really does have the characteristics of a controlled demolition using explosives. Rapid, complete, symmetrical onto its footprint. I pulled out my stopwatch, and later I had students doing this too. And we would measure the time of fall, and so I came up with 6.5 seconds. I'll talk about that a little more in the next slide. And I put this discussion and this little bit of research on Building 7 in my first paper. Now, the 9/11 Commission report, amazingly, failed to even mention the collapse of this building, this skyscraper. I mean, think of it. Downtown Manhattan in New York, 47 stories. That's taller than any building in my home state of Utah, by considerable, actually. And yet, not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report, which is supposed to give the most complete discussion of the events of 9/11. It didn't even mention it. The FEMA report, to their credit, did discuss the collapse of Building 7, but then they said, our best hypothesis, now this is some damage and then fires to cause this building to come down. No jets, right? Hit it. Our best hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence. I agree with them. A very low probability, approximately zero. I mean, think of it. If you can get just some damage, and they're emphasizing fires to bring this down, that means you could start a business, right? You could say, well, I'll go in and put some hit a few pillars. None of the columns in this building were severed by the damage, according to the reports. So let's see. We just do some random damage, set up some bonfires in the building, and then, oh, it was 7 hours after the towers collapsed. But okay, let it go for 7 hours. We have to keep stoking the fires to keep them going that long. Anyway, and then just watch her come down symmetrically straight down. It's a lot easier than setting up explosives, you know, and doing a controlled demolition. And yet, that's what they were saying. It must be fire. What else could it be? And some damage. But they do admit that their best hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence. The NIST then is charged to give the final explanation. They do have a preliminary report on World Trade Center 7. Not much. Their final report is long overdue. So I was reviewing, they had promised it again for December of last year. Of course, it didn't come out. They promised it for spring of this year. No, we're past that time now, you know. So I'm hopeful they'll come out with it. Of course, they know now that we have a group of scholars, engineers, and scientists who will take a close look at whatever they come up with. I assure you, a very close look. And so I hope they do a very good job, and I hope they do it soon, frankly. And the other thing I would like to point out is NIST has refused to release the photos and videos which they collected from the public at taxpayer expense on the collapse of Building 7. Now, we would like to get the release of those videos and photos. We would like to take a look. You see, we're part of the public, taxpayers, and so on. And we think we can help understand then what happened to this building and its collapse. As I mentioned, the building collapses in about 6.5 seconds. These are 1 second intervals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.5, plus or minus about 0.2 because things are obscured at the end. But then again, it's moving very rapidly, so the error bar is small. Free fall time for an object dropped from the roof is 6.0 seconds. Now, I hasten to point out, as I mentioned here, the 6.5 seconds has to do with the southwest corner, this corner, of the roof as it begins its downward motion. There is some motion in the middle as the thing starts to give, which is interesting. That's fairly common in controlled demolitions, where you have the center dip in a little bit, the sides pull in a little bit. But as soon as this starts its downward motion, it's just 6.5 seconds. That is very rapid compared to free fall time of 6 seconds. And then I looked at other demolitions, which I knew were controlled, for comparison. And these buildings come down in just over free fall time, very typically. Now, in order to do that, and there are papers about this in the journal, it is necessary to move matter out of the way. I mean, here you have the roof ready to go, let's say, and you have, let's just take a big crane, we'll take this piece, take the roof, and we'll drop it in air. And on the other hand, we'll drop it over 100,000 tons, roughly, probably more than that. Let's see, for this building, it would be about, a third of it, about, I haven't thought that before, about 150,000 tons, plus or minus, of concrete and steel. And which would fall faster to the ground, in air or falling through the path of maximum resistance through all this concrete and steel? Of course, the one in air should fall much faster. And even then, there'd be some air resistance, probably bring you up to close to 6.5 seconds for a roof falling in air. So very curious that it should fall that rapidly. And there we bring in these studies in the journal, principles of conservation of momentum and energy. As you hit something, it slows you down, and yet the roof falls at nearly free fall speed as if there's nothing in the way. You do that with explosive demolition. You move the stuff out of the way with explosives. You cut the supports. Not surprisingly, now we have structural professors coming to our assistance and making statements about this. We have, for example, Hugo Bachmann, professor emeritus at ETH in Switzerland. This is roughly the equivalent of MIT in Switzerland. In my opinion, WTC-7 was with the utmost probability brought down by controlled demolition done by experts, not by Al-Qaeda slipping in there, you know, during the hours when the building was sealed off and so on. No, it was done by experts, and it takes a little time to plan and accomplish this. Similarly, George Snyder, professor emeritus at the same institute, he said WTC-7 was with the utmost probability brought down by explosives. And there's a whole group now of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, led by Richard Gage. He's a very good architect, and who support these conclusions. I understand there's about 140 now at last count. So again, I used to hear this argument, well, there's no engineers that talk about this. Well, that is no longer the case. It's interesting that Building 7 housed a secret CIA site. According to the New York Times, their undercover New York station was in this 47-story building, which means, and by the way, Department of Defense and Mayor Giuliani's emergency management office was in there. So you find that this is a highly secure building, again. So that tells you that there had to be some sort of insider ability to get into these buildings. I understand Marvin Bush and Securicom, they were in charge of the security of these buildings leading up to 9/11. It's another point of interest, I put it here. The World Trade Center buildings were insured against terrorist attack about 6 weeks prior to the terrorist attack. Okay, so this guy, what's the expression? Made out like a bandit. I mean, it's just amazing that the Lucky Larry, I think he's been referred to. $4.6 billion approximately in insurance payouts on these buildings, not just this one, of course, but the buildings. I want to bring you up to date on development. We keep hoping for this sort of thing, and this relates to Building 7, so this is the appropriate time to announce this. This came out just last Tuesday in an article in Prison Planet, and it came out because of cooperation between Prison Planet, which is Alex Jones and company, and the Loose Change Boys. They're friends of mine, and you know, we're all working together. I hope you understand this. not a one-man show. And indeed, as we work together and as the 9/11 truth movement grows, I expect there will be more whistleblowers coming out like this one. So let's see what he says. His name is currently anonymous, will be released when the Loose Change movie comes out this fall. I know they're pushing hard to get it as in major movie theaters. That'll be quite something. And by the way, when that comes out, we need to be prepared to contact local newspapers, encourage people to see it, and that sort of thing. We need to get behind. It'll be like a wave, and we need to get behind and not just surf on the wave, but push it along, okay? Okay, so I'm quoting from the article by Steve Watson. You can read about it at Prison Planet. So this whistleblower was asked to report to Building 7 with a city official. He's a security fellow. After the first attack, which would be on the North Tower, but before the second plane hit, you see. So this is early on. And they were attempting to reach Rudy Giuliani, who had this office on the 23rd floor. But when they got there, they found the office was evacuated. In fact, he said there was still coffee steaming on desks and half-eaten sandwiches. So people had evacuated very quickly from this 23rd floor. Now these two guys are up there. And they started to get out of there as quickly as they could. They went down a stairwell, and when they reached the sixth floor, the landing we were standing on gave way. There was an explosion. So here's an eyewitness, and the landing gave way. I mean, it was hanging, you see. And so what they had to do is climb back up the stairs. It's a good thing they didn't go any further. And they made it to the eighth floor, where everything was dark. He heard further explosions. They finally made their way down to the lobby of World Trade Center 7. He said, and I'm quoting him now, "It was totally destroyed. It looked like King Kong had been through it and stepped on it. It was so destroyed, I didn't know where I was. It was so destroyed that they had to take me out through a hole in the wall, a makeshift hole, I believe the fire department made to get me out." Now, this is not the end of the story. By the way, this is a taped interview, and will be part, I'm told, of the Loose Change movie this fall. Avery and Burmis, Loose Change Boys, described how the individual had witnessed dead bodies in the lobby of Building 7. Now, before this, we were told that there were no deaths in Building 7. He said, not true, because he saw the deceased people in the lobby. He was told by the police not to look at them. And as the report goes on, this is vital information. It is in direct conflict with the official claim that no one was killed in the building. Furthermore, this individual was interviewed by the 9/11 Commission. Of course, his testimony does not appear in the 9/11 Commission report, another omission, which Professor Griffin has delineated so many of those omissions. Here's another one, a very serious one. As it points out, quoting, "Officials have lied in stating they have not come into contact with evidence of explosive devices within the building," because of this man's testimony. NIST also makes that claim about Building 7, that there's no evidence, they say, for explosives. Well, we have some now. Now, again, relating to Building 7, there was a piece of steel, a steel member that was found and analyzed using X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy techniques that will be on the exam. So please pay attention there. Okay. And, quoting. Now, this is in the Appendix C of the FEMA report. By the way, what I'm going to talk about here, again, FEMA, to their credit, says, okay, we don't understand. We're mystified by some things. But NIST does not treat this discovery. So they look inside the steel. It was weakened. I'll show photos of this again a little later as it relates to another discussion. Quoting from the FEMA report, and these scientists then, material scientists at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, evidence of a severe high-temperature corrosion attack on the steel, including oxidation and sulfidation. Sulfur got into the steel. With subsequent intergranular melting was readily visible. The severe corrosion, very unusual event. See, these guys, they're fire engineers, I understand, and material scientists. No clear explanation for the source of the sulfur has been identified. New York Times called this perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. Now, those of you who know my work and know why I'm smiling, is because sulfur is added to thermite to make this residue from the thermite, this hot molten iron from thermite, plus sulfur now, cuts through steel very quickly. And, of course, you get sulfidation. We've done some experiments, and we do observe this. So, Building 7 has a lot that tells us. I mean, to me, that is enough. And when I saw it, I thought, man, I've got to study this more. Okay, number two, lack of air defenses. And I notice this has been discussed somewhat at the conference today. I will go through some highlights that I dug out on in my research about this. I think it's a very important topic. Quoting from the Associated Press, the scrambling of fighter aircraft at the first sign of trouble, so for instance, a commercial airline goes off course, at the first sign of trouble is a routine phenomenon. In the year period before 9/11, fighters were scrambled 67 times. That's more than once a week. So airplane goes off course, you scramble a military jet, routine. NORAD spokesman says its fighters routinely intercept. That doesn't mean they go up and shoot them down, you know. No, they intercept. They typically are handled with a graduated response. So they try to help them out, find out what's wrong. If there is a hijacking, they try to get the plane to land safely, of course. Notice the day after 9/11, Commander-in-Chief of the Russian Air Force said, you catch the note of surprise here in his comment about what happened with no air defenses in America. Generally, it is impossible to carry out an act of terror on the scenario which was used in the USA yesterday. As soon as something like that happens here, I am reported about that right away, and in a minute, we are all up. Now, how long did we have then to intercept these jets? Well, let's look in particular at the Pentagon. I've assembled some data here. American Flight 11 hit the North Tower at 8:46. The collapse was at 10:28, so about an hour and 20 minutes later or so, hour and a half. Whatever. You've got the numbers, so you do the subtraction. United Airlines left Boston. It went off course about 8:42, crashed about 9:03. The collapse was 56 minutes later. And then American 77 left Dulles Airport, went off course at 8:46. And here's from a news publication. It went way off course towards the Pentagon, where a crash occurred 52 minutes later. Folks, that's plenty of time, especially near Washington, D.C., where you have Andrews Air Force Base and Bulling Air Force Base. So this is probably the most protected airspace in the world. Now, to say that in 52 minutes we couldn't manage to scramble a jet to do something about this hijacked aircraft, I realize it's a confusing day. And, of course, there's various reasons for that confusion. But this is striking. And as I talked to that there were no air defenses in this long period of time, as I talked to people about 9/11, this is one of the areas that they find is very fishy. Why were there no air defenses? Plenty of time. Now, the Secretary of Transportation on that day was Norman Mineta. He's since resigned from that position. But before the 9/11 Commission, he testified that he went down to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, basically a bunker beneath the White House. He said he went there about 9:20 on 9/11 and found Vice President Cheney in charge. And then, quoting now from Secretary Mineta, by the way, what I will quote here is not in the 9/11 Commission report. It's getting a little bit tiresome, but all these important data seem to have been omitted. And, of course, it's a good thing that this was taped. So we do actually have Secretary Mineta on videotape. So we have this statement from him. During the time that the airplane was coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man, who had come in and say to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 30 miles out. Now, at 50 miles out, there's still plenty of time to scramble a jet from these nearby air bases. When it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? Now, clearly, this young man is concerned about this. Well, are we going to let these orders stand? We don't know. That is, Secretary Mineta did not know just what those orders are. There are two papers that deal specifically with this event and Secretary Mineta's testimony in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and they both conclude that the orders had to be, and you'll see the arguments there laid out, had to be that there would not be an interception or a shooting down of this plane coming towards the Pentagon. Otherwise, it would have been shot down. That's in a nutshell. The vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And then, within a short time, there was a crash then, and hundreds of people were killed in the Pentagon. So I believe that we have a right to ask the question, what were these orders? Why were they allowed to stand? Why is this young man concerned, and yet the vice president not changing the orders? We have testimony also of April Gallup, who came out, so to speak, publicly, and about her experience. She was in the Pentagon with her baby in the morning of 9/11. She was working there as a service person, as I recall. I met her in California when we were both talking at a conference there. And she said it was very interesting to listen to her. Beautiful woman, as you can see, and her baby, she was surprised. She was driving in, and oh, here's her baby. She's got to drop it off, but she's late. She calls in, and the people there say, well, that's okay. In this case, just go ahead, bring your baby in today, no problem. Just hurry up and come in. So she did. Now, as she got there, it wasn't long before the Pentagon was hit. She was on the same floor where the plane came in. And she said it knocked her out, this collision. And she reached over the rubble because she couldn't find her baby, obviously frantic, trying to find her child. A beautiful little boy now, by the way, you know, about 6 years old. And she was able to just find his, she couldn't see the baby, but she could find the cloth and just reached him and got out of there. She did say that, and on reflecting about that day, she did not see any debris from a plane. She'd been asked about that. So that's interesting. Another interesting point is the FBI seized videotapes from nearby hotels and businesses minutes after the hit, which is rather curious. Again, taxpayer money, we would like to see these videotapes released to the public, all of them. Related to this is the fact that in 2001, especially during the summer, U.S. officials were warned of imminent attack by at least 11 countries. We also should note that there were over 20 war game exercises that day, as discussed by Webster Tarpley, and the fact that in May of 2001, Richard Cheney was put in charge of these defense drills. He probably has some interesting information for us about 9/11. 4 days after the event, Russian President Vladimir Putin said in an interview, I ordered my intelligence to warn President Bush in the strongest terms that 25 terrorists were getting ready to attack the U.S., including important government buildings like the Pentagon. So this idea that there was foreknowledge about, on the part of U.S. officials has extremely strong evidence and is not contested strongly anymore. It just seems that the U.S. media continues to ignore this important point. In Jane's Intelligence Digest, we read, it is rather strange that the U.S. media seems to be ignoring what may well be the most explosive story since the 11 September attacks. And they're talking about this these revelations that the United States was warned in advance. And not only seemed to do nothing, but somehow let the guard down so that the planes could get through without any interceptions of these planes. I want to mention, by contrast, FEMA had personnel in Manhattan, right near where the planes hit, the day before 9/11. Now, this is efficiency, folks. This is efficiency. You think about Katrina, when that hit, how long it took FEMA to get there to help out these people. When we knew for sure the hurricane was coming, and yet it still took days before FEMA could get there to help out. In this case, FEMA was there on the 10th, you know, with equipment. It's remarkable. And fishy. Okay. I haven't used that term before, but I noticed the backdrop here. And fishy comes to mind. Okay. So Tom Kenny, who is one of the first responders, was speaking to Dan Rather, and he said, "We're currently one of the first teams that was deployed to support the city of New York in this disaster. We arrived on late Monday night, that would be the 10th, and went right into action on Tuesday morning." Mayor Giuliani, who would also like to ask a few questions too. "The reason Pier 92, again near to the Ground Zero, the reason Pier 92 was selected as command center was because on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. So they came on the 10th. The drill was planned for the 12th. It had hundreds of people here from FEMA, federal government, state emergency management office. They were getting ready for a drill for a biochemical attack. So that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there, and the people, hundreds, ready to go. Now that is government efficiency, the day before. That's unheard of, I think. Remarkable. Oh, yes, his testimony was not included in the 9/11 Commission report. Now, if people say to you, "Well, it's all in the Commission report," you say, "No, how about the collapse of Building 7? How about Secretary Mineta's testimony? How about Mary Giuliani's testimony about this operation on the 10th? No, it's not all in that report. Representative Kurt Weldon talks about foreknowledge, one of the principal hijackers. This is before Congress, and he says, "Mr. Speaker, I rise because information has come to my attention over the past several months that is very disturbing." And that's the way I reacted as I learned about this. It was disturbing. "I have learned that, in fact, one of our federal agencies had, in fact, identified the major New York cell of Mohammed Atta prior to 9/11. Now, you may not know this, but what would you guess? Was Representative Weldon reelected last fall? The answer is no. Surprised in some sense. Okay, that is that topic. Now I want to talk about the World Trade Center dust, which has become of considerable interest to me in the last year, and particularly in the last few months. Here's some of the spheres. You can pick out the large sphere there, and there are also some small spheres. Do you see them? And as we look at these with an electron microscope, we find that these spheres are basically of two types, metal-rich and silicon-rich, so glassy-looking spheres under an optical microscope, and then the shiny metal-rich spheres. Now, you know, just right off, you say, well, these spheres, the ones especially, well, either one, to form a sphere like that means that it was molten. It's not somebody carving these into a nice little sphere, you know, molten. And then surface tension pulls the material into a spherical shape. And then as it travels through the air, the sphere will harden and retain that shape. So you have really quite a lot of information already just from this photo. And then knowing that iron is in there, I mean, as I learned about it, I thought, man, iron melts at a high temperature. And it melts at about 1538 centigrade, about 2800 Fahrenheit. So the temperatures, as we'll see, the fire temperatures, nowhere near hot enough to reach those temperatures just from ordinary fires, even jet fuel. No, you don't reach those extreme temperatures to melt iron. So how do you, and not only do you have to melt this stuff, but you have to spray it into the air so that you can form droplets. We did obtain some dust samples earlier this year from Stardust Hotel, which was demolished using explosives. This is a Las Vegas hotel that was controlled demolition, and we got some of the dust from that, from 9/11 community people that went out and gathered some of that dust. One of them said the security person hurried her away, but she got some dust before and sent it to me. I looked in the dust, and yes, there are these iron-rich spheres in the dust from the controlled demolition of the Stardust Hotel. But you expect that, right? Because they use C4 as the explosive to cut through steel, and as you cut through steel like that, you're going to get molten steel. Forming into drops then gives you spheres. So, I'm starting to put things together a little bit here. Before I go any further, I'm kind of excited about that aspect. I do want to talk about the toxicity, the danger of this dust, which is an issue before the courts now. Because what happened was that scientists immediately discovered the dust was very dangerous. For instance, Greg Swayze, U.S. Geological Survey, says, tests revealed the dust to be extremely alkaline with a pH of 12.1, and that some of it was as caustic as liquid drain cleaner. Now, you don't want people breathing in this terribly toxic dust. It was taken, thank you, from the workers, to protect the workers and people returning to their homes from the dust. So this fellow cares about people. He's a good man. And we'll see what the EPA said about this dust. But first, I want to point out that a lot of people now, estimated at least 15,000, have medical problems related to particularly respiratory disease linked to 9/11 and to this dust. We've all seen the dust. Here's Building 7 standing as this dust envelops lower Manhattan during a collapse. Now, there was an article in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and a number of newspapers, of course. It's based on a report by EPA Inspector General Nikki Tinsley. By the way, do you think she's going to keep her job for blowing the whistle on the EPA? No, she didn't. Okay, so she joins the club with us. Kevin, we're getting to get this club, you know. Anyway, she said the White House convinced EPA, so the statement about the danger first had to go clear the White House. And the what happened was the White House convinced the EPA to add reassuring statements and delete cautionary ones by having the National Security Council control the communications. And she dug through and found out what happened. There were cautionary statements changed to be reassuring statements. There were 5 releases within 10 days of the attacks, 4 more by the end of OT1, reassuring the public about the air quality. But soon respiratory ailments began to surface in the hundreds. And of course now it's thousands, and people have died due to the respiratory distress caused by this dust. Let me just quote from Catherine Freed. "We've known it was a cover-up since the beginning. I have talked to people who have escaped the dust, and they said it was just terrible trying to breathe that. So it wasn't too much of a surprise to most people. Yet the EPA had these reassurances that is published under the name of the Environmental Protection Agency. But this evaluation, and by the way, the EPA statement, one of them said, it's okay, go back to work in the financial district. I remember that in particular. So I think she's right, that there was this interest in opening up Wall Street rather than worrying about health, which shows a certain mindset, I think, of, you know, as opposed to protecting people, protecting corporations, which we've also heard at this conference. There are, of course, now lawsuits about this. Judge Batts, Deborah Batts, said, part of this lawsuit, officials who conspire, oh my goodness, she used that word, officials who conspire with others and who harm others can be held liable. Let's hope so. I did talk to some students about this. I think it's interesting, their responses. Is it right, here's what one or two of them wrote then, is it right to sacrifice some lives for the national good? You see, that seems to be, they catch on quickly, you know, is what they're doing, is sacrificing lives here. And then maybe the collapse of the buildings, you see, is in the same ballpark, huh? philosophy coming through. Honesty is the best thing for the people. She is not Machiavellian who wrote this. Okay, that's good. Some may think it's okay to lie about the dust in order to get Wall Street opened up, unless they're the ones who get hurt. Mm-hmm. Machiavelli said, and it was quoted by neoconservative Michael Ledeen, he said, sometimes it's necessary to enter into evil in order to achieve the most noble achievements. I'm paraphrasing a bit. You see this philosophy coming out? Oh, my goodness. And, you know, you can't deny that dust was dangerous, and yet they turned that around, the White House, and said, oh, just tell the people it's safe. Kind of makes me sick. Makes me real sick, actually. Now, I want to talk about the Iron Rich microspheres. Here, by the way, is Jeanette McKinley, a 9/11 truther now. Her apartment is across and about 100 meters away from the South Tower, across the street, down a ways. And when the South Tower collapsed, her a couple windows on her apartment broke in, and her apartment was just flooded with this dust. And she had the sense, and actually she told me it was a spiritual sense, to save some of this dust. She thought it was important. She put it in a plastic bag. Later I traveled to her home. She now lives in California. With some other scientists, we opened the bag and extracted some samples. And if you look with an electron microscope, this is what you see, the spheres that I showed you earlier. Here's how I collect the iron-rich particles, and just a small magnet. So the magnet does not touch the dust, but in a plastic bag then, I pass the magnet over top and pull the magnetic component out and gather it here. And then I put this on a sample holder, and into the electron microscope it goes. First, an optical microscope. This is what we see. You see some of the shiny spheres, which turn out to be metal-rich. And see this one? Transparent nearly, quite transparent. In three dimensions, I used a stereo microscope. These are really beautiful. And I managed to get some photos just this past week through the microscope. This with a white background. Now you can see the shiny metallic spheres standing out a little more. There is about 8 or 10 spheres here. You see, this is now with the magnetic extraction. So we do have chunks of the dust as well as the spheres appearing in this sample. Basically, we saw these two kinds, the glassy, transparent or nearly transparent spheres, and then the metal-rich spheres. Now, as I asked the question before, how do you form these iron-rich spheres? Here's some more. Considering that iron melts at about 1538, so you have to reach that temperature in order to get the conditions for the sphere to form. All these spheres to form. This one, by the way, is quite interesting. It's hollow. A piece broke off, and you can see that this sphere is hollow. We've noticed a few of those. And in this case, a cluster of spheres. Not quite sure how that formed, but quite interesting. A lot of information coming from the dust. As I told my wife, it's as Isaiah said, the truth will whisper from the dust, you know. Isn't that right, Jillian? I know she likes Isaiah as well. Okay, so let's see what NIST says about steel melting. I can't recall, as I read through much of the NIST report, any mention of these spheres, but they do talk about melt or not melting steel in these buildings. In no instance did NIST report that steel in the towers melted due to the fires. The melting point of steel is about 1,500. Now, this is on the test. I do want you to remember that. 1,500 to melt steel. Okay. If you prefer, 2,800 Fahrenheit. Normal building fires, it'd be a maximum, 1,100 Celsius. Okay, keep that one in mind. So there's a discrepancy, right? We can't get hot enough to melt the steel. Furthermore, the upper layer air temperatures is the air now above the fire. Could reach a maximum of about 1,000 Celsius. So again, a little below the 1,100 of the fire maximum. And so just nowhere near the 1,500 required to melt steel. They say in another place, expected temperatures about 1,000 degrees in the vicinity of the fires. Clearly not enough to form these iron-rich spheres. And yet, oh, here, I put in some more pictures. I wanted to show. I was just quite impressed with these little spheres that you can see in the dust, along with fibers and particles. Ah, here is Jeanette now. in her apartment, cleaning up. You see the windows that have broken. And her apartment is over here, about right here. So basically, it's very interesting. As that tower collapsed, the windows broke, the dust rushed in. So you get some dust from the other buildings as they collapse. But nevertheless, it's basically a snapshot. She got in there about a week after the collapse of the buildings and collected the dust sample, which tells us so much about the origin of what happened during the collapse, which I think is very exciting. I did ask Jeanette, could I mention her book, which talks about the dust? It's here, The Need to Remember. And she said, it's interesting to note the book actually opened the door to the dust research. She sent me a copy of her book about the same time, I think at the same time, as she sent me some dust. And she also noted that we were told to go down to the basement because the second tower was expected to collapse any moment. That's in her book. Okay, we have now another sample, this one from Damon Bean and his friend. Can you see this material here? There's a briefcase here, a calculator, a wallet, and an umbrella, which survived the collapse of the North Tower. Damon was working on the 18th floor. He decided to get out of there, out of the North Tower. And a good thing he did. He exited then before the collapse, obviously. And about a year later, his stuff was sent to him. During the cleanup, through the rubble, his briefcase was found. There was identifying papers, and so the police got that to him. The officials got that to him. It was opened this year after they talked to me, actually, and asked if I'd be interested in some of the dust. I said I would. Here's what we see inside the dust. It's mostly silicate spheres, which is silicon, oxygen, calcium, some aluminum. By the way, I did write to one of the proponents of the mini-nuke theory. We've been exchanging some email. I said, look, this stuff survived the crash. It's not true that everything gets pulverized. Also, in Jeanette McKinley's apartment, there were large chunks of concrete. It's not like everything gets pulverized. That's not true when you look at the data. I'm not quite sure where that got started. But anyway, this all survived and offered to him. He could test the materials for neutron activation, which I recommended in a paper last January in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. If you really want to pursue this mini-nuke hypothesis, look for the activation of materials. For instance, iron, as you hit that with neutrons, you'll get some radioactive isotopes generated. And so we'll see. That's the way to resolve such questions.
You're listening to Professor Stephen Jones on some of the key points refuting the official explanation of the events of 9/11. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We continue with the conclusion of Stephen Jones' presentation from Vancouver, and we'll follow that with a clip of his significant new research findings.
Okay, here's the electron microscope that we used, and here's a pattern that we see. As I mentioned before, X-ray energy dispersive spectrometry, it's a mouthful. The peaks show what elements are present. For example, iron has these three peaks, one here, and one down here. You see, labeled Fe, ferrous, Fe for iron. Manganese, this is steel melted with an oxyacetylene torch.